Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
So many countries have gone to the polls this year already. Far-right parties are doing better in certain countries than in previous elections. But what then of the often convoluted task of forming a government and how all of that plays out? To discuss more of this, I'm joined in the studio by Graeme Finlay, who's lecturer in the School of Politics and International Relations at UCD. Good to have you back, Graeme. Nice to see you. Now, you're going to bring us two examples today, and we're going to start in the Netherlands, aren't we? They voted 4 months ago. People might remember we were talking about that election here. Still no government, though.
Yeah, and what we're seeing are two different ways of coping with a rise in a far-right populist party, especially dramatic in the Netherlands under Geert Wilders, by far the largest party. And so you would think that they would be in government and you'd think that they would lead the talks. But the responses of political systems tend to be either to completely exclude that party because it's toxic or to find some way of having them cooperate in government. The Dutch one has been particularly complicated. They started talks. I mean, previously, the parties would have nothing to do with Geert Wilders and the Party for Freedom. They can't do that anymore. So three parties decided to go into a talks about a coalition, you know, a center-right party, the upsurging populist farmer citizen party, and a new party called the New Social Contract, which it was formed just for this election and is also a sort of center-right party. And those talks are not going well, as you can tell, because we don't have a government in the Netherlands yet. And in fact, the people inside them describe them as poisonous, largely, I think, due to the demands of Wilders' party, Wilders' personality. And at one point, the New Social Contract just walked out. Mm-hmm. And the reason they walked out was interesting. It wasn't just the fact of Will Wilders' policies, some of which are illegal, like banning everything Muslim, having a Nexit referendum, you know, to leave the European Union, but the state of the finances in the Netherlands. Once Peter Omtzigt, the head of the party, realized how bad the finances were, how bad the fiscal situation was, he thought that the demands of say, the Party for Freedom were just, you know, pernicious for the national finances. So that's why he walked out. But they're back in, and the way they got back in, it's really interesting. They have these reports from the way the talks are going, is to exclude all the party leaders from being ministers in the government. So Wilders had to Wilders had to concede that he was not going to become prime minister. And so what they're going to have is half technocratic government.
Oh, like the old Italian model.
Exactly.
Not that old,
but very much like the Italian model. So, you know, the talks went so badly that they're, and the finances apparently are so bad that they're going to have a technocratic government, which is composed of 50% ministers who are old political hands from the parties. Mm-hmm. Although it looks like the New Social Contract is going to maybe not be in government, but support from outside. And
confidence and supply.
Confidence and supply. And half of them are going to be from outside. They're going to be experts from outside.
Okay.
Outside Parliament.
Why don't they just have another election 4 months on?
That's a really good question. I think nobody's got a huge appetite for an election. I mean, if they really can't work it out, there will be another election. Mm-hmm. But I suppose key to that is Wilders' agreement that he's not going to be prime minister. He could force an election just by refusing to cooperate. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of reasons for why he might have chosen that path. One is he just could not impose his desires on three other parties. But also it puts him in an enviable sort of place. You know, he purports to be furious, right? And he wants to channel the anger of his supporters, right? They have been denied their rightful chance to govern this country. But he can now stay in Parliament and criticize his own government and continue to sort of build his brand, stoke the anger of his supporters, and continue to grow his base.
With one foot in and one foot out.
One foot in and one foot out, and still play the role he's played for the last 20 years.
And what's happened to the finances in the Netherlands? What's behind all of this?
They don't make me totally privy to them, but, you know, the Dutch have always been very, very fiscally sort of responsible, if you think about, and really stressed the importance
of that. I think that's what most people would imagine.
You know, yeah, well,
we'd be surprised. Yeah.
When we were going through our own sort of financial crisis, the Netherlands was one of those countries which really sort of talked a lot about moral hazard and the need to, you know, for the pigs, including us, to put some manners on their public finances. And they would really have been an ally of Germany at that point. So I think partly for that reason, they, you know, are particularly conscious of being fiscally responsible. But like everybody else, they've been hit by cost of living increases, which involves extra expenditure, but also the fallout of COVID.
Mm-hmm. And paying for that. And that's causing all of these problems. Right. Well, let's go to Portugal now. Again, they've gone to the polls already earlier this month, wasn't it? Earlier in March.
Yes, March 10th.
The government hadn't completed its full term, though. So just explain to us why they were voting in the first place. What prompted the election?
Yeah, the Portuguese example is really, really interesting. And Portugal is a very, very interesting country. Again, we've been covering a lot of these elections, and you get everything from co-opting the policies of the far-right party, as you see in Denmark, and just sort of marginalizing them that way, letting them be in government, like we've seen with the Finns party in Finland, with major ministries, having them support the government from outside, like we see with the Sweden Democrats in Sweden, having them capture the government, like we've seen with Meloni in Italy, and making a very successful turn from a populist far-right party into what seems like a mainstream European politician.
What seems like.
who nevertheless gets to impose her anti-migrant policies, right, with the European Union's help. But in Portugal, they're taking the just keep them out strategy. And that's because Portugal is going to celebrate its fiftieth anniversary of democracy in April, and yet the people of Portugal are at least many of them are sensible that for the first time they have a far right party which has significant support, and they are concerned about this. So it's traditionally been governed by this center-left party, the Socialist Party, and maybe it's slightly confusing for some of us, a center-right party called the Social Democratic Party. And they've switched roles over and over again. They have coalitions. Party discipline is very strong in Portugal. And they were an example until relatively recently of a very successful kind of left-wing party. The Socialist Party was in power. It, you know, rolled back a lot of the austerity measures which the Social Democratic Party had brought in after the financial crisis, and at the same time maintained sort of fiscal discipline. Mm-hmm. And so it really seemed like a successful leftist party, and they were elected with an absolute majority in 2022. However, a series of scandals, corruption scandals, which are not unknown when you see these two natural governing parties trade places, especially among the Socialist Party, really wrecked that majority in the sense that there were lithium mines in the north, which are, of course, tremendously important for car batteries and electric batteries.
Mm-hmm.
Some kind of batteries, various batteries. And hydrogen processing and data centers in the south, also something we're not unfamiliar with here. Those contracts, those deals involved allegedly, right, a lot of bribery and a lot of kickbacks, a lot of influence peddling and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So these are all allegations leveled at the center-left party governing since 2022.
Exactly. And before, you know, mm-hmm. since 2014. And specifically the Prime Minister, António Costa. And there also was a major scandal at the national airline, TAP, which they're trying to sell to some larger airline, involving really large severance packages for people who went on to become ministers in the government.
Okay.
And so this outrage to public, I think it's fair to say, who are suffering through their own cost of living crisis. And it culminated in the raid on the Prime Minister's residence, on the arrest of his chief of staff, on various ministries, on local councils, looking for documents in these corruption charges. There are allegations that Costa himself was involved. It's important to stress that he has not been charged with anything yet. But all of that really undermined the tenability of the government. And Portugal has frequently had snap elections. And while Costa resigned pretty much the same day as that that raid, he went to the president, and the president could have put in a sort of caretaker government for the rest of the term. But all of the other parties in the country wanted an election. And it's completely up to the president, De Sousa Santos, whether he has an election or not. And he went for an election, which is why it's the first full majority, single party majority government in Portugal's history not to serve out its term.
OK, so tell me what happened in that election then.
Well, you might have seen it if you spend a lot of time watching TV about elections, as I do. You know,
that's what you were here for.
Exactly. Yeah. You might have seen that there was really, really high turnout. There were really long lines at the polls. Turnout was up 8.5%. People were getting there to vote both for Chega, with an exclamation point, which means enough, which is this far-right populist party, and or against it. And so it was a very keenly watched election. It's also the closest election in Portugal's history. So the coalition of the Social Democrats, the Democratic Alliance, got 80 seats. 78 of those seats are the Social Democratic Party. The Socialist Party dropped tremendously down to 78 seats. So they're very, very close. It's the closest election history. Mm-hmm. Chega surged from 12 to 50 seats. So they demanded to be in government. And this was a real shock to Portuguese people. Many of them find Chega's policies toxic and do not want to see them in government and fear that their very stable and cozy sort of, not consensual, but, you know, centrist politics is going to be upended.
And what do they want, Chega?
So Chega, it's an unusual party, and it was an unusual election. They sort of made that Ventura, the leader, was in the Social Democratic Party, and like many cases, drifted into founding his own party, Chega. And he became sort of notorious for anti-Romani sentiments and was, in fact, accused of racism. But it is an anti-migration party. It is an anti-Muslim party. It is a law and order party, but of a sort of muscular sort. You know, the idea of castration for rapists, bringing back the death penalty, all of which is illegal under European Union law, right? You know, or certainly under the European Convention on Human Rights. And a lot of other harsh treatment for anybody it sees as an enemy of the state.
So what is the state of play now with government formation?
Well, so they had a choice, right? Chega was demanding a place at the table, to be in government, not just supporting from the benches, and softened some of its policies the way Geert Wilders tried. You know, Geert Wilders got rid of most of his illegal policies in the Netherlands, but it wasn't enough. So what we saw was the Social Democratic Party, despite a few of its members of parliament really insisting that they get in coalition with Chega, which is the only way it would work for them to have a working majority, absolutely refusing to have anything to do with Chega. And confronted with that, the Socialist Party rather quickly agreed that they would support the formation of a government by the Social Democratic Party or the Democratic Alliance. But not a blank check, right? They said they will support them trying to form a government. They will vote where they agree, and they agree about 70% of things. But on crucial matters where they don't agree, they are not promising to go with them. Okay. So it's a recipe for a certain instability.
All right. Well, Graham, we might come back to that when they eventually arrive at a decision about what to do.
The government's being announced today
and
going into office on April 2nd.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on them. Thank you so much. That's Graham Finley. We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.